Don't turn it off now. You need this stuff. Tampa Bay's Tan Talk Radio Network.
Is the retirement planning landscape changing in ways we previously had not anticipated? Let's have a look right now on The Voice of Reason.
You are about to enter the arena of real news and factual commentary on The Voice of Reason here on the Tan Talk Radio Network. Now, here is your host for today's program, Ed Golly.
And joining me in the studio today is Daniel Mannix from Provise Management Group right here in Clearwater. And Daniel, thanks for coming in to talk a little bit about how the retirement landscape is changing for the generations today that might be starting to plan for retirement. Tell us a little more specifically about what you do for Provise.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me, Ed. Sure. Good to be back on. I was here with you 3 years ago, so great to see you again. Yeah, so I am a senior portfolio manager at Provise Management Group. So we're an independent advisory firm. We're managing about $1.9 billion in assets across 1,300 clients or so across several different states. We also manage 50-plus retirement plans for small businesses, and we help walk clients through every part of their financial life. Think of us as the doctor for your financial health.
Depending on whom we ask, the American economy today is either a complete train wreck or the best it's ever been. Being in the position of planning for people's retirements and managing their portfolios, what is the appraisal of the economy by Provise?
I would say it's pretty strong right now. I think the employment situation is healthy. People are spending money, which is one of the most important things for the U.S. economy. That's two-thirds of our gross domestic product. Housing market is pretty strong. The economy looks pretty good. With that said, there is likely going to be a recession at some point. It's a part of the economic cycle. It's healthy. It's really not healthy to not have recessions. Any recession that would be coming up in the near term here for the U.S., we expect to be pretty shallow, pretty mild in nature, what we would call a garden variety recession. And that really just helps to flush out some of the what we would call zombie companies that are really just hanging on by a very thin thread. But more importantly, at Provise, we take a very long-term approach to our investing. So whether the U.S. economy goes into a recession next year or 3 years from now, really doesn't impact the long-term projections and plans that we have for our clients.
If we went back in time by 1 year, and we're sitting here a year ago, were you not at that time presuming that we were going to go into a recession at the end of the calendar year because of the increasing interest rates?
So we were certainly outside of consensus going back to, and it's written so you can fact check me on it, but going back to the fourth quarter of 2022, we were not expecting a recession in 2023.
Wow.
We were expecting that it would be sometime in the first half of 2024. Now we have updated that to be closer to probably the back end of 2024, possibly the beginning of 2025. And really the reason for that shift is less of how the economy is doing and more about what the Fed is doing. So the Fed, unexpectedly to us, got really dovish in that they came out and said, hey, even if inflation doesn't get back down to 2%, which is our target, as long as it's somewhere in the 2% range, we will cut interest rates, which is what they're looking to do in the back half of this year. And what that does is it really eases financial conditions. It allows some of those, again, zombie companies to hang on for a little longer.
And so really the Fed controls the interest rates, right? The Federal Reserve?
Indirectly. So when we say the interest rates, we're talking about the federal funds rate. And that's really the rate that banks at the Fed will borrow and lend to each other of the reserves that they hold at the Federal Reserve Bank. The Fed sets a target for that rate. They set a target range. It's gotten to the point where the Fed is so powerful that as soon as they put a target out, everybody adjusts to that target, assuming that they will actually be able to do what they say their target range is. And really, a lot of the U.S. markets depend on that confidence in the Federal Reserve to be able to do what it says it's going to do.
Yeah. So now, as I understand it, the presumption is that interest rates are not going to need to be brought up anymore or raised anymore, that if anything, they're going to begin nudging down. And that's the consensus among all the planners and the government itself, isn't it?
That's right, Ed. I think we have seen the top end of this interest rate hiking campaign, if you will. It has been swift and it has been extreme by historical standards. The real question is, how much is it going to go down? That's what everybody's trying to figure out. Where is it going to end up, and how quickly are we going to get there?
Yeah. Does the administration that's in power or Congress really have very much to do with that, as opposed to the Federal Reserve?
They're not supposed to, right? So the Federal Reserve is a quasi-governmental agency, right? They are not elected in the way that Congress would be elected. And they are not an actual government entity. They're supposed to be separate. And so they're not, whenever you hear Jerome Powell, who is the chairman of the Federal Reserve banking system, speak, he says, I don't want to get involved in politics at all. I'm not going to answer anything that has to do with politics. And Congress is the same, and the same with the presidency as far as getting involved with the Fed. We've heard in the past with different administrations kind of demanding or asking that the Fed would do things. But ultimately, the Fed has control over what it does, and it's really not in the business of politics.
Yeah, yeah. All right, let's talk more about individuals now. We hear it's never too early to start planning for retirement, but for someone living paycheck to paycheck, it's probably a little too early, nevertheless. As someone gets into their mid-30s to early 40s and starts to have a little bit more income than they need, especially if they're disciplined, how would one start to set aside money for a retirement portfolio? What do we do with it? We don't just stick it in the bank.
Yeah, I would not just stick it in the bank. Savings accounts are getting you nothing right now, and haven't for a long time. The most important ally that you have is time. I would say start as early as you can with as small of an amount as you can. Whatever you can afford to invest, go ahead and invest. And for someone who's not financially savvy, I'd simply just throw it into a S&P 500 ETF. ETFs are exchange-traded funds. They're very low-cost vehicles. You can buy SPY, which is the largest S&P 500 ETF, for next to nothing, a couple basis points, which is 0.01%. So it's not going to cost you a ton, and it's going to give you some skin in the game. It's going to allow you to potentially grow with what's going on in the economy, in the market. But ultimately, again, time is going to be your friend. You don't have to have a ton of money to invest. In today's democratic way of investing, I would say, the markets are really open to a lot of people. And again, time is your greatest ally, so start as early as you can. The best day to invest was yesterday. The second best day is today.
But you we're talking about markets here, right? The U.S. stock market is still a very safe place to invest?
I would never call the stock market a safe investment because you are taking on risk. No matter what stock you're investing in, no matter what stock market you're investing in, you have to essentially look at it as you are investing in businesses. You're becoming a business owner in several different companies. In the S&P 500, you're becoming a business owner in 500 different companies. And sometimes companies lose money. Sometimes companies go bankrupt. And you, as an equity holder, a shareholder, would lose in that outcome. Now, over the long term, you are going to be rewarded for taking that risk. There is no free lunch in finance. And so the idea is I have to be willing to take risk in order to get return. But the good news is it has shown to be a profitable undertaking over the long term. And there really isn't a bad time to get started. I mean, if you invested, let's say, right before the great financial crisis back in 2008, if you invested in the end of October of 2007, never put another dime in, just reinvested the dividends, just put your money in the S&P 500, you would have more than tripled your money by today. That's about 10% a year. I mean, that's pretty big.
Wow. I thought the assumed standard was about 5%, but that's on what a portfolio can generate, right? That doesn't take into the account the growth of the portfolio over time, isn't
it?
Yeah,
let me clarify that. So over the very, very long term, let's say over the last 100 years, you can expect about 8% return.
Annually?
Out of equities, correct.
And now that includes the growth in the value of the equities?
That is correct.
Portfolio. Okay.
So that would be about 8%. Over the last 20 years or so, it's been higher. 20 to 30 years, it's been about 10%. So you're doubling your money every 7 years. Using the rule of 72, you just take 72 and divide it by your return. Yeah. That'll give you how long it takes to double. Now, when we talk about the return of a portfolio, the portfolios include more than equities. So a lot of portfolios will have a mixture of stocks and bonds. And the reasoning for that is diversification. It gives you some zig when the rest of the portfolio zags. So the idea is I own some bonds in the portfolio that I know are going to pay me income, and we're actually getting income now, which is nice. Interest rates are not zero anymore, so I know I'm going to get some income, and I'm also going to have some protection on the downside. So it's a bond. I'm a debt holder. Instead of investing in these companies as a business owner, I'm a creditor to these businesses.
Okay.
And so the mixture of bonds, which are safer, have a lower return because, again, with risk, you get reward. You take less risk, you get a lower reward out of bonds. Out of the equity component, you're taking on more risk, you'll get more reward. Put those two together, somewhere around mid-single digits.
Okay. But now here we are with a stock market on the doorstep of 40,000.
Yeah.
Isn't it a little too good to be true, maybe? Let me put it this way. Would you have expected it a year ago or 2 years ago to take this kind of a climb?
So even though we were not expecting a recession last year, we did not expect that the market would rebound as quickly as it did. But I just gave you an example of probably the worst timing in the market over the last 100 years, right before the great financial crisis. So through the great financial crisis, through the pandemic, you more than tripled your money. Let me put it this way. Timing the market you talk about risk versus safety. It's a very risky strategy to try to time the market.
Right.
Over the last 20 years, if you were investing in the S&P 500, again, I keep using the S&P 500 because that's really the benchmark for the U.S. equity market, which is the largest equity market in the world. So the S&P 500 over the last 20 years, if you missed the 10 best trading days, that's a 20-year period. If you just missed the 10 best trading days, you lost about 50% of your return. So that's how important timing is. And time, the importance of it, over the last 50 years, if you were investing globally, over a one-day period, your chances of a positive return are about 50-50. It's a coin flip. If I just invested for one day, 50-50 chance of a positive return. If I extend my holding period to 10 years, you have about a 95% chance of a positive return.
Yeah. Now, I haven't heard you say anything about gold. Okay, and I hear people telling us, advertisers telling us that we should get into gold, that it should be a part of our portfolio as a hedge against a major economic crash. But what's the fundamental evaluation of gold from the investment standpoint?
We get a lot of questions on gold. It's looked at as a safe haven. It's done pretty well over the long term, actually. So the example I gave you of over the last 20, 30 years, S&P up 10%, gold's up about 8%. So healthy return, absolutely. At ProVis, we're not super bullish on gold. I wouldn't say I'm against it. I don't see any problem with having a small allocation to it in an investor's portfolio. But there's a couple problems that I have with gold. The biggest one would be that it doesn't pay me anything, mm-hmm. right? So stocks are going to pay me dividends. Bonds are going to pay me interest income. Gold isn't going to pay me anything. It also doesn't have any productive use. It's used in very little industrial items, gold is. But it's really just mostly for jewelry. And so trying to find a value for gold is really about supply and demand dynamics. And you really mm-hmm. don't know how much gold we have in the world. I mean, you keep discovering some. And so the supply is kind of going up. The idea has always been that gold is a good inflation hedge. Well, that didn't work out too well in 2022 when inflation really started running up. Gold didn't do too well. So I wouldn't necessarily call it a great inflation hedge. But again, I'm not super against it. It is at all-time highs, so I wouldn't consider it a great investment at this point. But having a small portion of it in an investor's portfolio, I don't think it's bad, just because it adds some diversification against equities and bonds.
Of course, Tesla didn't pay any dividends either, but gold has probably never taken a spike like that stock did, has it?
No.
I mean, that was just unprecedented.
No. Yeah, so Tesla had a great spike, and even more so more recently, NVIDIA, with a huge run-up here recently. The difference, I would say, between investing in a Tesla or an NVIDIA or whatever other company and gold is you actually have earnings, right? So your return is going to be based on your earnings growth. It's going to be based on any income that you're getting, and it's going to be based on the price that investors are willing to pay a multiple of on those earnings. The problem is when you don't have earnings, when you don't have income, the only thing you're left with is just the price that somebody's willing to pay as a multiple on the value of it. And at that point, it's a little bit of speculation.
Yeah. I heard somebody talking about the fact that, I think it was Mika Brzezinski was talking about she is addicted to getting an expensive cup of coffee every morning on her way into work that'll cost, $12 to $15. And she was told that if she cut that out and took that money and just invested it every day, and did so with the same discipline that she buys the coffee, over a period of maybe 30 years, she would have an eye-popping portfolio that could grow to $1 million to retire.
Yeah.
So this kind of discipline is something that's hard for a lot of people to really implement, but it is proven, isn't it? As a way to really, even if you don't make much money, to be able to build wealth by just starting and staying with it consistently.
Absolutely. That just goes back to our former point there and discussion point that it's really about getting in as soon as you can and, as you say, being disciplined with what we're actually doing with our money. And we could run the math on what that would grow to exactly, but chances are it's going to be worth more than buying coffee.
And isn't the world's economy just becoming more interconnected now than it's ever been? Meaning that after the Second World War, we had an economy where we could build and manufacture everything we needed, from cars to televisions to washing machines, and now we almost need to rely on other countries providing so many of the things that we use. I look in any label in any garment I own, it was made in another country. I think we only make like 3% of the clothing we wear.
Wow.
And so we have this economy that really inherently relies on the rest of the world working together to have a sustainable economy anywhere. Isn't that true? Isn't that changed just so radically since the 60s?
That's certainly the case. I think relying on the global economy for our domestic needs has probably never been greater. I think the pandemic really highlighted how susceptible we were to any disruptions that would happen overseas. And more recently, what's going on you know, over in the Red Sea and going on in the Middle East, that's causing issues for our energy prices. There's been a lot of conversation about deglobalization recently, trying to get our pharmaceutical supply chains domestic, trying to get different textile supply chains domestic, our semiconductor supply chains, trying to get them more domestically rooted. The truth of the matter is that you can't do this overnight. Supply chains are extremely complicated and intertwined, and it takes a long time to, for example, move everything out of China. It's going to take a long time for us to get to a point, if we wanted to, where we would do everything domestically. But I personally don't see that ever being the case.
Yeah, but that is what's going on with Intel, isn't it? Isn't that why the government is
either providing,
I wasn't sure whether I heard it as a loan or to Intel to expand their factories, or a direct distribution from the government?
Yes, I believe it's both. I believe there's a direct incentive, $8 or $9 billion plus having access to a potential loan facility where they could pull another $10, $11, $12 billion. That's part of the CHIPS Act that was enacted in order to grow our domestic production of semiconductors. Again, going back to the deglobalization mindset, trying to hedge our risk of any geopolitical issues with China and Taiwan, trying to do more of the building here. And Intel is at the forefront of that. They weren't really historically ones that would produce chips for other semiconductor companies, but they're one of their new goals. I believe they're investing $100 billion over the next 5 years, a lot of that happening here in the U.S., creating, I want to say, 30,000 jobs, a good chunk of that being construction jobs as they're building things up, but then having jobs for their company as well directly. The idea is, let's have control over this extremely important computing power.
Yeah. And similarly, is it presumed that they couldn't raise that kind of capital through sale of stock, which is the capitalist model, isn't it? That they can't just separately go about ramping up that fast just through the conventional means of stock markets and selling stocks to investors to gain
probably not at the same rate of return for their investors. They look at every project based on an internal rate of return, and they would likely not get that if they were not getting the incentives from the government. So I think it's a pretty good example of the public-private partnerships that, I mean, examples of it, you know, across history, going back to, you know, Boeing building jets for World War II.
Yeah, and bailing out the auto industry years ago, right?
Yep.
With the loan.
That's right.
That proved to be successful.
Yes.
But now, an investor in his or her early 40s could take higher risk investments than somebody on the doorstep of retirement. Isn't that a fundamental rule for investing?
Absolutely. I mean, the rule of thumb is take 100 minus your age.
Okay.
And that will give you the allocation or the percentage of your portfolio that you should have in stocks.
Okay, but how risky is a high-risk investment? What are we talking about here? We're looking at something that'll give us a higher return or a higher rate of growth, that if it's successful, and if it doesn't work out, the presumption is that we still have the years to earn that money back that we might have lost in a high-risk investment. But how risky is the highest-risk investment that you would put a customer or client into?
Probably not as risky as most. We're a pretty conservative shop, I would say. And when we say higher returns, it's higher expected returns. You know, we can't guarantee anything, but over the long term, you're expected to get better returns out of those high flyer investments, I would say. You know, we really don't chase a lot of those highly speculative growth type investments. We're going to be sticking to our knitting, which is going for larger companies that have really strong balance sheets, are actually producing cash flow, actually paying out their investors in the form of dividends or share buybacks. And so any allocation that we would have to what we would consider higher risk, like, for example, a small cap stock, U.S. stock, or emerging markets stock, they would be a much smaller percentage of the portfolio because you don't want to be too highly impacted by those returns. Now, when we say that you can take more risk when you're younger, it's because of volatility. It's, you know, the movement around of those prices. And if you're younger, as to your point, you have more time to see that through, as opposed to when I'm 80 years old and I need the money tomorrow, if the stock goes down 40%, I have to eat that.
You've got a fire drill on your hands.
Yes.
Yeah, but still, preservation of the capital is really the primary focus whenever we're investing.
That's really the floor. Absolutely. That's the bottom line. That's the floor. And that's obviously been a little more difficult recently with inflation, right? Because inflation is eating away at our purchasing power. So we at least have to beat inflation. Mm-hmm. So then anything above that is going to be our growth engine, yes, as we're trying to build the portfolio.
So are we loading up on Truth Social stock this week? That is unbelievable. What the heck is going on? A company that has is losing money, so it has no income, is suddenly seeing this incomprehensible expansion in stock price because of the merger with a company that's really... I guess what do we call them?
It's called a SPAC. So a special purpose acquisition company. And this is a way
for
companies to bypass the IPO process, the initial public offering process. So basically what happens is there's a group of investors that create a shell company. It doesn't do anything. Its sole purpose is to raise capital to go out and buy another company, bring that company public. So DWAC, Digital World Acquisition Company, was the SPAC, right? And so they're buying TMTJ, I believe it's called, Trump Media. TMTG, I'm sorry. I believe it's something of that nature. But they bought that private company. And the idea now is, you know, they merged. And the ticker symbol is then changed.
DJT.
So it's Truth Social, and it's DJT for former President Trump's initials. And so, yeah, to your point, it's hard to reconcile an $8 billion valuation with a company that has lost $5 million. They've made $5 million in revenue. They've lost
$43 million in 2003, right?
23, yeah. So it's very reminiscent of the meme stock craze that we saw back in 2021. I'm talking about GameStop. I'm talking about AMC theaters. I'm talking about these small companies that really got a lot of buzz on social media, particularly Reddit, and were able to garner support regardless of what we would call intrinsic or fundamental value. So, yeah, it's hard to reconcile those two, but it's also difficult when you have ardent supporters that are willing to buy at any cost.
Yeah, and it even goes back to the dot-com craze in the 90s, right? Same thing. Companies that weren't really producing anything just appeared to have the prospect of producing something, and so they were generating
investments. You just put a dot-com at the end of your name, and your stock was going to go up.
Exactly.
Yes.
Well, I'm Ed Golly. I'm talking with Daniel Mannix from ProVise, which is right here in Clearwater. You also have an office in Tampa. Time for a short break for some important messages, after which the voice of reason is going to return with a question I seem to be eternally unable to get an answer to, which is this. If the government can print all the money it wants to pay its debts, why do we have any national debt?
Hi there, I'm Robin Savage, stand-up comic. Are you sick of the news getting pushed around by two sides, always saying the other side is wrong? You deserve to enjoy the news.
That's what's up, Robin. I'm your host, Mac James, from Stand Up for News. We're stand-up comics, and we tell the news. The news doesn't have any legs and can't stand up for its own self. Join us and special guests like local hero comics like Donnie Stopa, all the way to legends like Tommy Chong, every Thursday, 7 p.m. to 8 p.m., here on WTAN Radio.
You're listening to the Voice of Reason on the TAN Talk Radio Network.
Arbor Life Tree Service is Tampa Bay's finest tree service company. From trimming, pruning, fertilizing, and insect control, to grinding and removal. You get an experienced, ISA-certified, and veteran-owned firm that can do any tree job, large or small. With our fully equipped fleet and trained crew members, we care for trees of all sizes, whether you're government, contractor, business, or homeowner. Don't trust just anyone with a chainsaw. Call Arbor Life Tree Service at 727-330-1999 for a quick and free estimate. That's 727-330-1999. Arbor Life Tree Service. They go out on a limb for you.
Don't turn it off now. You need this stuff. Tampa Bay's Tantalk Radio Network.
If you would like to comment by email, you may reach the Voice of Reason at WTANvoice@AOL.com, and we'll be glad to respond to any questions, comments, or insults that you have about the program. Daniel Mannix is joining me today and is going to offer up a response to my eternally unanswered question about the government's ability to print money. First of all, isn't it true that the Federal Reserve prints the money? Or am I misguided? Am I not really understanding what's going on here? The government doesn't just print up money and then say, well, here's how we pay our debts.
It's a little convoluted. So essentially, the Federal Reserve is not printing money. What they basically do is they have these member banks that hold reserves at the Federal Reserve, right? So they essentially, the Treasury, the U.S. Treasury, which is a different operating body, right? They're the actual government. They are going to issue debt. They will issue debt in the form of Treasury bonds or notes or bills, right, depending on the maturity of it. And they're these member banks that are part of the Federal Reserve, which are known as primary dealers, yeah, will buy those treasuries. How they afford to buy those treasuries is the Federal Reserve goes ahead and credits their reserve account with extra cash in order to cover those purchases. And so that's the process of printing money. It's not actually printing new bills, but they are essentially creating these excess reserves out of thin air for these accounts for these Federal Reserve member banks.
Okay. So we still need to sell T-bills to pay our debts.
That's right. Right.
And who's buying most of the Treasury bills now? I remember, 20 years ago, I heard that it was England that was buying most of our Treasury then. I don't know, is it now Saudi Arabia? The scuttlebutt is China's buying all our debt. That if they quit buying the debt or they call in the debt, which they can't because you can't call in bills early.
That's right. That's right.
And our economy would collapse. But what's really going on here?
So it was China that was the largest foreign holder of U.S. Treasury debt at one point, but it's now Japan, actually. Japan has a little over $1 trillion of U.S. Treasury debt, but that's a relatively small portion of who holds our national debt. It's actually mostly domestic. So if you look at who holds U.S. national debt, about half of it is held by retirement. So if you combine Social Security, which just buys U.S. Treasuries, the Social Security Fund, and retirement funds and pension funds, that's about half of it. The Federal Reserve owns another 20%, so there's 70%. So you have about 30% that's owned by foreign buyers, with, again, the largest being Japan.
Okay. Now, when you talk about pension funds, these can be either corporate or state pension funds?
Yes.
Yeah. And they buy it because it is such a secure investment, isn't that right? It's virtually a non-risky investment, even though it doesn't pay as high a dividend as like corporate paper.
That's right. Exactly right. Again, you get extra reward for extra risk. So buying an Apple bond is looked at a little riskier than buying a bond from U.S. government. So you're going to get paid a little bit more there. But yes, those pension funds, retirement funds, U.S. Social Security, they are looking for cash flow. They're looking for a safe investment. They're going to turn to Treasury bonds.
And they have a better model to predict the distributions they're going to need to pay out in the future, right? They know when their employees are going to retire. They know what the actuarial table is.
So cash flow is very important. They they have what's known as asset liability management. So they're essentially trying to manage their cash flows, what's coming in, what's going out. Hey, if I have X amount going out, if I can cover 70% of that with U.S. Treasuries, great. Now I just need to make up the other 30%.
Okay. All right. So we're really on more secure footing than some would have us believe with respect to our debt and who owns it and who can call it in and who can cause our economy to crash. Isn't that right?
Yeah, to your point, you can't call U.S. Treasury debt. So if I own a 10-year Treasury bond, the U.S. government can't come to me 5 years in and say, hey, we're buying this back from you. No, they can't do that. And yes, it is mostly domestically held. So there's the overwhelming majority of it being domestically held by entities that we would say are not hostile to the U.S. So I wouldn't be concerned in that sense. But with that said, you still have a pretty good chunk being held by, you know,
right,
global entities.
Similarly, if I'm holding a 20-year Treasury bill, I can't go to the government and tell them I want to cash out. I could sell it to you, right?
That's right.
But I can't get it back from the government. The government doesn't need to pay that until it's due.
That's right. And you, if you bought it from the U.S. Treasury, you bought it likely at par value, we would say, at $100, let's say, being the par value. Yeah. If you go to try to sell that, you might sell it at a gain, you might sell it at a loss, depending on what interest rates have done between the time of your original purchase and when you're trying to sell it.
But that interest rate has been nudging up to, isn't it about 4.25% to 4.5% now that the government would look at as its obligations? And
on the 10-year, the 10-year Treasury is around 4.25% at this point, a little bit below that. You actually have higher interest rates on the short end. So like a 6 month or a 2 year is going to cost you somewhere with a five percentage points. But that's a very unusual and usually not long lasting phenomenon. We call it an inverted yield curve, where if you think about it, it doesn't even make sense. If I'm lending to someone, I'm going to charge you a higher interest rate if you're borrowing from me for a longer period of time. It's the exact opposite right now. You're getting the lender being us, right? Because we're lending to the government when we buy the Treasury bonds. We are requiring a lower yield or interest rate on longer borrowings than we are on shorter borrowings.
And isn't that because we can't anticipate the future interest rates?
The big reason is inflation.
Oh, okay.
The understanding, okay. So when we look at the interest rate on something like a Treasury bond, we've stripped out risk, as we talked about before, right? So we don't have any of that interest rate due to risk from a credit perspective. But there is inflation risk, and there's what we call duration risk or time risk. So again, the longer I'm holding on to this, the more I expect in return. Inflation, as we know, ran rampant back in 2022, 2023, really started to put the brakes on it as we ratcheted up interest rates. The idea is inflation 10 years from now is going to be lower than it is 2 years from now.
Okay. What is your concern, though, about this ever-increasing national debt, now up to $34 trillion? And it seems to me that every year our budget goes up, but our revenues seem to have sort of flatlined. As I understand it, we now have a budget of like $7.2 trillion to run the federal government and about $4.5 trillion in revenues.
Wow.
So we're borrowing the balance every year.
Sure.
And we're now seeing projections that we're going to have $50 trillion of national debt by mid-century, maybe by 10 years earlier than that, and then we're going to need to really spend a disproportionate amount of our revenues to service that debt because we can't default, right, as we need to borrow more and more money. So it seems to me there are only two solutions to that. One is to literally print the money to pay the debt, which leads to hyperinflation, or default. But if you're helping somebody plan for retirement under that scenario, what are you looking at with regard to that debt?
Yeah, those options don't sound great.
No, they don't.
So in my conversations, Ed, with bond managers, so people that are actually managing the fixed income funds that we invest in, that's what's going to keep them up at night. Is the Treasury going to issue debt to a point where there is just not enough demand, where they are overissuing and they have to do that because of the debt burden? And essentially what that does is it increases the cost of debt, which then increases the debt burden even more, right? Because they have to issue debt in order to pay the interest expense on the debt that's already outstanding. So that's really the situation that would keep a bond manager up at night. I mean, there's really a couple things, you know, that could potentially happen. One of them, as we saw last summer, I believe it was August, there was a downgrade of the U.S. credit. Right, by Fitch Ratings, they downgraded by one notch, so still investment grade rated, of course. What's very counterintuitive, that's happened twice now in U.S. history, the other one happening back in the, I believe, 2013 by Standard & Poor's, is investors will flight to safety, and they essentially buy Treasury bonds, which is kind of counterintuitive when the Treasury is downgraded. But the market has performed well after it's happened, actually. In both instances, through the rest of the year, it was up 5 or 6%. Will that happen again where, you know, the credit rating of the U.S. government keeps going down to, let's say, junk? I highly doubt it. If they are, then everything else is even below them. So I don't see that happening. I think, essentially, what we have to come to terms with is that we are going to have entitlement reform. I mean, 50% of your federal spending is, you know, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security.
Yeah.
There has to be some level of reform. I mean, we see that Social Security is going to take a... benefits will take a 20% haircut in probably about 10 years, totally wiped out in 15.
Wow.
There's definitely a need to have some reform. The problem with that, of course, is nobody wants to be at the head of the ship when that actually happens.
Right.
So, in the meantime, we keep printing debt. We do it to stay afloat. You hope that GDP growth catches up and overtakes. At this point, you're over 100% of GDP, your debt.
Uh-huh.
So, not a great place to be. There are a few things that the government can do to try to right size the ship, but it didn't happen overnight, and it's not going to get fixed overnight.
Yeah, what if Social Security were privatized? Would that help? I know Baby Bush tried to do that, and he just couldn't get any traction on that plan.
If you privatize Social Security, I think you would have to. You'd have to cut the benefits, and you'd have to increase the retirement age. Because if you privatized it, it'd be a company that's trying to be profitable, right? That's trying to balance the budget, as we would hope that the government does, as all of us do personally.
Yeah.
That's what a privatization would look like. And so that would be painful for current recipients and future ones of Social Security.
Tell me how you work at Provise. How do you make the decisions about where to place your clients' money? How do you collectively evaluate the markets, the international markets? Where do you get your information?
Yeah, thanks for the question.
Tell us how all that works.
It's kind of
which is to say, you don't work by yourself in isolation.
That's right.
You
in
work
a dark
with
basement.
The team. Okay.
Yeah. We have an investment committee. So this investment committee meets on a monthly basis, and we go over everything from what's going on in the economy, what's going on in the markets, how does that change our outlook for either? How does that change our positioning and our clients' portfolios? Is there anything that we like that maybe we shouldn't like anymore? Is there things that we didn't like that maybe we like now? So we're doing that monthly, and then, of course, daily, looking at the markets, keeping abreast of everything that's going on, understanding, because there's a ton of news out there, you know, how to filter everything out, filter out the noise, understand what's impactful for our clients and their long-term goals, and making decisions accordingly. I'll give you one example. Back in 2021, mid-2021, we saw the writing on the wall that inflation was likely going to kick up, interest rates were going to kick up, we were going to have to change our positioning pretty drastically. And so we spent the back half of 21 making sure that we were positioned in a way that would help protect us against higher inflation and just higher interest rates overall. And so beginning of 2022, we made those changes. We basically changed half of the bond portfolios for our clients, and in a way that would help protect us. And that was back when the two-year treasury note was at less than 1%, and now it's above 5%. So the timing turned out pretty well at that point, but it's ever evolving, it's ever changing. We constantly have to look at it. Markets are fluid and dynamic, and you know, your yesterday's news is yesterday's news. Yeah. And so what's going on today? How are we positioning for the long term in a way that will allow us to accomplish our clients' goals, and making sure that we are comfortable with what we do and making our clients comfortable really with, you know, our prowess, our ability to understand what's going on and make the right decisions for them ultimately.
Now, how is your industry likely to react to this election that we have coming up? For example, if the Republicans take the White House, do we anticipate oil revenues to be higher? Or do we find international markets to be riskier? Or do you try to anticipate this, or do you just wait for the election and then see where things are going and then react quickly?
Ultimately, a lot of it is sentiment and noise. When you look at the impact on the markets of presidential elections and congressional elections, it's not very impactful, believe it or not. It can cause some noise in the short term. Obviously, if there's any major overhauls, let's say like tax reform back in the Trump presidency, that's going to have an impact. But actually, if you look at all of the different regimes, so if you had a divided Congress, if you had a Republican, Republican Congress with a Democratic president, all these different combinations that you can get, you get pretty good returns in all of them. The best returns is probably a split Congress, where the president is a different political party than Congress, if Congress, if both houses are held by one political party. So ultimately, the best Congress is kind of one that's inept, one that's not going to do a lot that changes, because the market's all about expectations. So if I have more confidence in what I'm expecting going forward, then I'm going to invest accordingly. If I have less confidence of what's going to happen, then I am going to ultimately be more risk averse and not be willing to invest. And so a lot of it has to do with confidence in the outlook going forward. Okay. Now, of course, to your point, as an example, if there were certain policies that impact different sectors, one more than another, those are things that we'll look into. But it would only be if we truly believe that it's more than rhetoric and these things are actually going to get done.
Yeah, okay. Now, sometimes I hear advertisements claiming that the stock market is actually risky, that pretty much any kind of investment is risky. But if I give my money to this guy who's advertising, he says, I will guarantee you risk-free income. But he doesn't tell me how he's going to do that. Mm. What do you presume he's really going to do with somebody's money to take any risk out of investing it?
That's interesting. Without knowing the gentleman, I would guess if he's claiming a risk-free investment, it would have to be a treasury bond, which we would consider to be risk-free. And in that case, you could just go out and buy your own treasury bond.
Okay.
The other thing would be if it's a higher expected return than treasury bonds, like let's say guaranteed 6%, and treasury bonds are giving you 5%, it's probably an annuity. An annuity, which is an insurance product. And so, again, remember, there's no risk-free investment. So, yes, the stock market has risk. And if there's an annuity that gives you 6%, somebody's taking on the risk. So the real return is probably higher than that, and the insurance company is pocketing the difference. I mean, there's a reason why insurance companies make these products. They're making money, right? It's a profitable enterprise for them. So whether it's no risk to you or not, somebody's taking on the risk, and they're getting paid for that risk-taking.
So they're turning around, potentially putting the money in the exact same place where he said you don't want to put it, right?
That could very well be the case, Ed.
And so we're relying on the stability of the insurance company to pay out
that. It's risk-free to the point of the insurance company remaining solvent.
Yeah.
Once they go under, as we've seen very large insurance companies can, you're not guaranteed anything.
Well, Daniel, we have a couple minutes left. Can you tell us a little about your background and how you chose this for a career?
Absolutely. So I am a local guy. I was born and raised in Largo, Florida. And I went to USF, University of South Florida, where I got my finance degree. I started my career on Wall Street in 2008, which was not the best of timing, the beginning of the great financial crisis, but wow, what an experience, what a learning experience for me. Spent about 4 years up there working in different sales and trading roles among different asset classes. And then made my way back down to Florida here, working in equity research, where you're essentially covering a group of stocks. Like I covered bank stocks and real estate stocks. Did that for some time, and then made my way over to Provise 4 years ago. So I've been with Provise Management Group for about 4 years now, and I love it. It's been great. We have a really strong team. We have 13 or so financial advisors that really are those doctors that I spoke about. They're really walking our clients through all of the situations that come up in life: births, deaths, divorces, marriages, moves, you name it, and helping our clients plan for retirement, how to protect their money, how to have a legacy, pass on money to their children, charities, whatever it may be. And we also have some nonprofit organizations that we manage their money as well, which is great. We're very involved in the community. There's a lot of the members at the firm that are part of different boards for charities and nonprofits around the area. Really big to giving back to the area. As you mentioned, office in Clearwater as well as one in Tampa. And yeah, there's a philanthropic purpose to what we do. We really enjoy getting the opportunity to help people.
Can a firm like yours get too big in that it starts to lose the intimate relationship with the customer if you get too large?
That could always be a possibility. You know, I think one of the big value adds we have for our clients is the high touch, white glove service that we provide for our clients. And you don't have a portfolio manager somewhere in New York that's doing trades in your account, doesn't know anything about you, and just throws you into this this catch-all model. I'm right here, you know, and I meet with the clients as well as, you know, with the advisors to run them through everything that's going on. It is important to keep culture, especially in today's work world where there's hybrid, there's remote work. And so Provise has been really keen on keeping that culture.
Well, thank you very much, Daniel, for coming in today. I hope our listeners have learned a lot from you. I know I have.
Absolutely.
Our quote for today is from John Kenneth Galbraith, who said, "The function of economic forecasting is to make astrology look respectable." All right, tomorrow morning at this time, join Paul Molloy for Freedom Works. Up next, we'll check in with national news from CBS, and then stay tuned for Patsy with a Z, your host for Joy on Paper. And I hope you'll join us again next Thursday for another edition of The Voice of Reason. Along with Daniel Mannix, I'm Ed Golly, reminding you, if the statement seems a little too implausible to be true, don't believe it just because a conservative said it.
Make them prove it.
WTAN Clearwater
FM 106.1
WDCF Dade City
FM 102.3
Listen.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts. I'm Steve Kathan. Sentencing day for the man who was once a cryptocurrency kingpin, Sam Bankman-Fried, who oversaw the epic rise and swift collapse of FTX, faces decades behind bars. CBS's Cammie McCormick.
His customers lost $8 billion. FTX lenders, $1.3 billion. He was convicted in November of fraud and conspiracy for illegally using billions of dollars from depositors to buy luxury properties and private planes.
And the judge said in court today that Bankman-Fried lied in his testimony during the trial. Correspondent Chris Van Cleve is following the work in Baltimore at the scene of the collapsed Francis Scott Key Bridge.
The Navy is sending barges with heavy lift cranes. The Army Corps of Engineers and Coast Guard also have resources coming to the Baltimore area. That will be the salvage effort in order, one, to get those four remaining bodies, but also to get the waterway clear so the Port of Baltimore can reopen. It's the nation's ninth busiest port. Some 8,000 port jobs hang in limbo.
In an exclusive interview with CBS's Charlie Daggett, Ukraine's President Zelensky says his country can defeat Russia on the battlefield. The months ahead, though, figure to be difficult.
While lawmakers struggle over the decision to continue supporting Ukraine, do you think Russians are taking advantage?
Russia is using that 100%, not 50-50, 100%. We have almost no artillery remaining.
A former Israeli hostage is speaking out about allegations of sexual abuse while in captivity at the hands of